Hey, everybody, welcome to another edition of the Anything But Typical podcast. This is going to be another fun one because I just met Chris about a week and a half ago. And when I heard his story, I'm like, oh, dude, you got to be on the podcast. And I'm so glad that he's going to be sharing some of his story with you because it's pretty interesting. And there's a lot of lessons that will directly apply to every entrepreneur out there running a privately held business. And even if you're not, you're going to be able to get a lot out of his story. So, Chris, knowing you've got four kids between the ages of 2 and 7, you are a busy guy. And as you had said, yeah, my free time is, you know, taking them to a park or a playground where we can get some energy spent so that you could actually get some sleep. So
yes.
I love it. So here's the scenario. You've just taken the family wagon and you are pulling up to the park of your choice. The kids are bailing out. You're undoing the car seats and somebody sees you and your tribe walking over to the playground and they start talking about you because they recognize you, but they're unaware that you can overhear everything that they're saying about you. What would you want somebody to say about you, Chris?
Awesome. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I appreciate it a lot. And this is a great question. Probably the first thing that pops to mind, I'll give a little story to provide some context. Several years ago, my wife and I were traveling in California. I was actually at a leadership conference, and we love history. So we went to the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library, and we love learning about the presidents and the history and that. And as going through the library, we got to the end and was loving it, was loving everything, and talking about his death. And I started reading, and Ronald Reagan was not, I obviously knew who he was, but I learned a lot because I wasn't into politics and he was president when I was very young. And so reading through it and I literally started crying. Tears came to my eyes. Last thing I thought would happen in the middle of a Ronald Reagan Presidential Library. And I was talking about at his services, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher came over. They were very close while they're both serving, and left a note in the guest book in the Blair House when he was visiting Ronald's wife, and said, "Ronnie, well done, thou good and faithful servant." And it brought me to tears. And so when you ask that question, I think to myself, that's what I want. I want someone that when they look at what I'm doing, they say, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." And in context, what does that mean, you know, in our world, in life, with four kids, right? Chasing them around, getting them fed and put to bed every night, and then hopping up tomorrow for school, right? And my wife and I spent some time on this as we take our family very seriously and leading the family very seriously. And we several years ago, we sat down and get some core values that were core values for us, that were going to be core values for our family. And so if someone was talking about me, my wife, our family, I would want them to center around that. I would hope they could see what those core values are and that they would say things around those. The first one is to know God personally and to show God's love to everyone. That's obviously deep within our faith, and that we want to not only, you know, be a Christian who says, you know, hey, we go to church, but more than that, have a relationship with God so that we know how to share his love with others and other people can see that in us. So I'd hope that'd be evident. Number two, and this has a lot to do with my past and entrepreneurial journey, is be courageous and never fear failing. And to me, that's everything. Fear can be such a hurdle that we have to get over. And if I can teach my kids something, that's one of the core principles that I want to make sure to instill in them, is to not be afraid of failing, because that's part of the journey. Number three is to maximize what God has given us, be good stewards of what he's given us. And what Margaret Thatcher said to Ronald Reagan, well done, thou good and faithful servant, comes from a parable where Jesus is talking about maximizing your talent. He's blessed us immensely and using that to maximize our talent by being courageous and pushing and growing and pushing the envelope and failing and falling short and getting up and trying again. That's part of it, to do so. So, and then the last one that is, you know, been a something I've been passionate about since I was in school is a love to learn. Just a nonstop love to learn and grow. And that obviously fuels all their other core values as well. So if I heard someone talking about me, number one, I would hope it would be that my kids were being nice to them on the playground and didn't push somebody. But after that, if they're talking about who I was as a person, I would hope it would fall within those core values, because that's obviously what I strive to do.
Wow, what an intentional answer. I love it, man. I mean, It's as unique as everybody that we've had on here, isn't it, Ben? Like, everybody has such a unique answer, and I really like that. It's very true to who you are, at least based on the interactions that we've had in the past week and a half or so. And we've had a fair amount in spite of a lot of things going on. So anyway, Ben, go ahead and take it away.
Yeah, Chris, unbelievably purposeful answer there. I appreciate you starting us off that way. So Chris is a regional managing partner for Jay Galt, but you mentioned, Chris, in your answer, your entrepreneurial journey leading up to this. And that's really where I want to start, because there's a lot of that tied into how you ended up where you are today. So I want you to just start there. Take us back to your first entrepreneurial type exposure, your first interests. Let's start off there.
Yeah. Great question. I appreciate that. So in reality, it starts when I started working, right? And I actually, I don't say this too loudly with my kids around, but I went to all of 2 weeks of school and I was on my own, and I had a full-time job supporting myself. I played soccer in college, and soccer starts before the school season, or before school starts. So I was already about a month into soccer, school starts. Now I was juggling soccer, school, and working full time. And I had to make a choice, and I was making plenty of money to support myself, and I saw a career. So I chose that. And went on my journey. And as I worked in small businesses throughout my 20s, one thing in hindsight that I didn't actually connect the dots on until much later is I got promoted in each business to some kind of manager and some kind of, you know, leadership role, small business. So obviously it wasn't that's not a big thing when there's a small family business or whatever. But every single small business I worked at, I tried to buy. I literally would go to the owner and say, "Hey, I'd like to buy this. I'd like to be a partner. I'd like to be a part of it." And I didn't realize that until, you know, in my 30s. And I was like, yeah, that's literally what I've been striving to do, is to continue to, you know, push the boundaries and grow a business and make it my own. And so through my 20s, worked through several things. My stepfather actually owned a retail flooring company. And so he gave me a part-time job at first in sales. Said, you know, "Hey, why don't you try out selling? Think you'd be good at it." Hired me full time, and in the first 2 years there, we doubled the revenue for the company from $1.5 million to $3 million a year. Tried to buy the company, tried to make a deal with him, like, "Hey, I'd like to take this over." Ended up being hired by a Fortune 500 company to be a sales rep in the flooring business. Did that for a while, and then eventually moved down to Charlotte from up in New England, and made the choice to come down here to a growing economy that was a little bit cheaper to live, and more importantly, growing and no snow. Those are kind of my requirements. So Kate got down here and ended up in another small family business, two brothers that owned a business. This one was a little bit bigger. I ended up in about $25 million a year in revenue, ended up running the business for them, and leading them to acquisition. They sold the business, and I got offered a contract to stay on. And I finally was at the time ready to take the leap into my own. So I graciously passed on signing a 80-page 5-year contract with a private equity group, and said, you know, I think I have a better path. And I started my own company, a flooring company. That's what my experience had been in. And here in Charlotte, started a flooring company. And that's where my entrepreneurship roots really really took root.
So before we get into that business, I'm curious, you said there towards the end of you turned down that contract because you were ready to take that next step. What in yourself, in your life, anything gave you that feeling or confidence that, okay, I'm ready to take this step that I've been tinkering with, toying with for the last so many years?
That was the moment. And same thing there. I tried to buy the company, made them the problem I had, which I realized in hindsight, is I didn't have the money ever.
That can be a problem.
Right. $multi-million. So it was always owner financed in my offers. But what the core behind that was, to your question, is that I always wanted to push. I'd grow the revenues, I'd grow the business, I'd put in process, and I always wanted to take it in different directions. And I wanted the freedom to do that, right? And I wanted the freedom to be able to study the market, figure out something that I thought would serve the market well, and then execute on that. And in hindsight, there's nothing wrong, you know, with any of the owners I worked for or with. Really what it was is we had different risk tolerances. And that's perfectly acceptable, right? You know, they're in their late 50s, early 60s, looking to retire. And, you know, here I am in my 30s at the time, you know, trying to explode. And so we had different risk tolerances. And so that's really what ultimately led me to, like, you know what? Time to put the money where your mouth is. You know, stability is one thing, but let's scratch that itch and let's take that jump and that leap. I've done it on several different levels for other businesses. You know, all things come to an end. I can work hard, and that's a good starting place.
Yeah. Time to do it for yourself.
Yep.
So take us into that experience, because it's a completely unique experience compared to going into somebody else's established business and helping them grow, right? You're providing fuel in that scenario.
Yep.
So with this, it's ground up. So talk to us a little bit about that founding experience you had.
I tell you what, the word founder did not mean anything to me, right? Founder and owner were to me similar things. Mm-hmm. Not anymore. The word founder I have so much respect for any of my fellow entrepreneurs who found a business. Because to your point, you start with literally a blank piece of paper, nothing. And not only do you have to develop the plan and the strategies and all that, but every single process along the way. So start the company, flooring business. The company that I had just led was specifically doing national builders, you know, these large nationals who build thousands of houses here in Charlotte. We would do the flooring for them. Obviously, I wasn't going to go down that path. I wasn't going to take away from their business. I went into retail again. It's like, great, you know what? We're going to come up with a service that's a shop at home service, salespeople, vans, go to people's houses, help them pick out flooring, et cetera. So that was kind of my model to start with. First 9 months, it's just me. And so, that's the grunt side where it's a lot. It's not only are you trying to, you know, grow revenue and get profitability and all those things, but more importantly, you're trying to find market fit. You're trying to find, you know, specific strategies in every aspect, right? In your marketing, in your sales, in your product assortment. You're really trying to narrow in every one of those things. And then obviously you wear every hat. Right. I would do the marketing to generate the lead. I would go sell the lead. I would provide the quote. I would order the materials from the manufacturer. I'd be at the warehouse when they got delivered. I would hire the installer to install it. I would give him the materials and explain to him what's going on. Like it's every step of the way. And then I would, you know, get the books ready and invoice them at the end. And so but that's the way it has to be. And what you do is you learn the nuance of every one of those jobs, so that as you grow, there's no one's pulling wool over your eyes about what that looks like, because you've done it. A story that always sticks with me about being a founder, and I've told this to several people as they've gone on a journey. About 9 months in, I decided to hire my first employee. Going to be a customer service office. I'll hire someone who can be at the office while I'm out selling and you know, wear multiple hats, but generally speaking, customer service. And went through the interview process. I'd done interviewing throughout my career, so that was pretty straightforward. Found someone, made the offer, hired them. picked our start date, did all of our onboarding stuff, and gave us a start date. And so the day before, I get done with kind of my typical day of work, and I realize, like, I got to do a little straightening up in the office here. I had a small 800 square foot office with a 5,000 square foot warehouse, and I've been the only one there. And I had a female customer service coming in, and I'm like, well, I haven't even been in the female bathroom in 9 months. So let me go clean that up. And what it led to was about 6 hours of work hanging up a paper towel holder in the bathroom, right? Putting a mirror up, cleaning, getting the computer set up, right? Dusting, like just making it somewhat presentable. Well, it happened to be my birthday as the timing comes out. So it's my birthday. I'm at the office to 8 o'clock at night. And I look down at my phone and I get an email. I look at the email and it's this employee starting the next day saying, hey, today was my last day and my company made me an offer to stay and I took it. So I'm staying with them. And so you go home and you celebrate your birthday with my wife. And at that point, I think I had one 2-year-old or 1-year-old at the house. But that's the roller coaster of a founder of an entrepreneur. It's what's up next? What do I do? There's highs, there's lows. You're sacrificing a lot, and it's all towards taking that next step forward. And so that's really that's what I'd say. Being a founder is something that those first 9 months are everything for me, because you're laying the foundation of your business.
With that experience, especially being, hey, this is the first time I'm bringing somebody on, talk us through your reaction there. Is that something that you were able to handle and move forward and learn from? Was it something that you wallowed in for a bit? Because I think especially early entrepreneurs, you can get caught up in lots of different ways of how to handle that scenario.
Yeah, 100%. It's one of those you learn and keep moving. I mean, honestly, what I probably did is I think I sat there for about 30 seconds in disbelief in her office that I had just gotten everything put together, right? And honestly, I opened up Indeed, flipped the job ad back on and said, here we go again. Yep. And start over. And then literally went home, told my wife that it's going to be another couple of weeks. We got to find someone else and keep going. I think those lows, if you will, are just part of the journey, right? You learn. And so now it gives you something else to dig a little bit deeper in next time you're interviewing somebody to really make sure. And so honestly, from there on, I specifically remember one of the things that I would ask in my interview process that I had never asked before in all the interviewing I'd done in my career. I asked, do you know what it's like to work for a startup? Do you know what it's like to work for a small company? What are your expectations around that? Do you know what it's like to wear 12 hats, right? If you think you're going to come in, do one thing over and over and over again, you're not. And so you learn about that. You learn from those experiences. The very next person I hired ended up being the person that stayed with me the longest through the entire company. Wow. it all works out. It's all part of a bigger plan, and you just keep moving. That's kind of the theme song, right? Just keep moving, learn and move on.
Yeah. Yeah. I asked that partially because early in the business that I've got now, Destination Wealth, the first large advisor that I was acquiring was going to bring like 120 million in assets, and same exact scenario. He was going to come over the very next day. He put in his notice and they threw six figures at him to stay. And so I got the exact same phone call, and I know that feeling and still remember it. And it's you either let it bother you and you suffer from it, or you learn from it and you're a better leader and entrepreneur because of it.
Exactly. Exactly right.
It's a great question that should be asked by every salesperson as well, which is, so in your case, Chris, like, okay, now let's just pretend that your current employer throws this crazy amount of money at you. What are you going to do? Because in the sales world, it's the same thing. It's like, all right, so you say that you want to move your account over to BGW CPA. Great. Are you prepared to have that hard conversation with the current CPA that has been disappointing you? That's an important question to ask. So we live and learn, man. I mean,
It all
you
goes
said
to
that.
motivation. We have to, in the
Yeah.
sales process, in your discovery, right? It's how you got to get to the core motivation, right? If their
Yeah.
motivation is simply to, in my case, get another job, then okay, but you're missing something. I've had people I've interviewed who have done nothing but bash their current employer. They're unethical, and now you don't agree, and I'll do this. I'm like, I completely understand. We make them a job offer, they get a counter offer from the current employer, and they stay. I'm like, you've been telling me how unethical they are. Now they throw more money at you, and so it really just got to always get to the core motivation of what is really making this decision for them. Is that money? Is that service? Is that quality? Is that timeline, et cetera? Because ultimately, that's what's going to make that decision.
Yeah, that's right.
Keep taking us through that business and let's transition from, all right, you founded it, you got through that first initial phase, and now you have an established business. What does it look like from there? How do you then pivot to more growth, more stability, things like that?
Yeah, so one of the things that I've always been, I guess one of the books that made a big impact on me was E-Myth, and entrepreneurial myth, and about having systems, processes, et cetera, right? That the franchise model, make it so it can be duplicatable, and you can replicate it as you grow. So one of the things that I harped on from day one is that it's going to be harder, but everything we do, we need to write down. So as we brought on our first warehouse guy, our first sales rep, our first office manager, customer service, et cetera, it was my job to take the nine hats I was had been wearing, take one off, but hand over at least the start of a SOP. Like, here is how we do it, as precise as we can be. We don't invoice when we feel like it. We invoice at 9 a.m. the next day after the job is done. Period, end of story. Right. And so those things is kind of that would built the foundation for us, so that we could grow. And so once we had what I liked about the business model is that, we're doing shop at home flooring. So there was really no limits of throughout Charlotte. If you have a retail store, then you draw from 10 miles around you and people draw them there. With our model, we could go anywhere, within, an hour drive around us. And so for us, the scaling looked like hiring more sales reps. So that was what my career has been in sales. So that's the last hat I took off. And so I built the team around in the other areas. And then we started hiring sales reps and growing. And I think the first year, by the end of the first year, we did about $1 million the first year. And then second year, we jumped to about $4 million in revenue. And that was just by hiring more sales reps and then just duplicating the process. So I tried to use the 80-20 rule, that, the 80% of your sales come from 20% of your products. And so let's simplify this and just make this really simple so that we can grow, pretty efficiently, and it's easier for everybody, et cetera. And we started growing like that. So that really became the next step for it. And so year two was really just kind of getting standardizing everything and going through our growth. That led us into year three. Year three, we got an opportunity to take on some national accounts in another side of the business. I generally call it the multifamily or commercial side of the business. In specifics, we were getting these national companies that were buying these single family houses and then turning them into rentals. And so they would rent out these properties. So I happened when I had moved from Charleston back to here, I lived in one of these properties. So I knew who these companies were. I spent 2 years prospecting them, going after them, trying to build a relationship. And finally, it paid off and we got into one of them. And what was interesting is because we had these processes in place that we used in retail, we went and sat in this meeting boardroom with a bunch of them, and we were competing against about a $300, $400 million flooring company that's in the Southeast, all over the Southeast. And I could just tell these guys' eyes were glazing over. Like, oh, we'll give you a quote and you'll do this and do that. And so I finally was like, hey, listen, I'm gonna give you exactly our processes. Like this is what we do every day. It's like, see these iPads? I had it with me. I'm like, we'll come into your house and we'll do a laser diagram right here on the iPad. So we can show you exactly what the floor plan looks like and exactly where the flooring is going. And then we hit these buttons right here and we'll give you a quote. Literally, by the time we walk out of the house, we can email the project manager, wherever he is in the city, a quote for that. I was like, so our guarantee to you is within 24 hours of you giving us a house, we'll have you a turnkey quote for that. And they literally just sat up and, did you say 24 hours? I'm like, yeah, like literally instantly. Like that, and that's not a stretch. It's what we do in retail right now. We go to their house, we measure, we give them a quote on the spot. So it's a standard. And he goes, well, the company doing it now, your competitor, $300 million company, takes a week to get us a quote. I'm like, well, time is money. If you can shave a week out of your turn until you can get this listed, how much is that going to save you? And how much is the corporate going to be happy that you can get these rented quicker? He's like, you're telling me. And so that got us in the door. And so we started a second side of the company, which I was very happy to do, a little bit of diversification. Obviously, you know, being a little bit lower margin, but higher volume side of the business. And we took on two or three of those national companies and started down that. And that really sent us into hyper growth. And so we took on a lot of revenue in year three. They asked us to go to Raleigh with them. So we opened up a Raleigh warehouse in year three, started doing all the work in Raleigh and Greensboro as well. And so we started growing from there. And so end of year three, we ended up about $8 million in sales. And then heading into year four, we kind of got through COVID in year three and we kind of, you know, had the hiccups through there. Year four, we kind of opened up and everything was going good until it wasn't. And that's where the story changes.
Yep. There's a little foreshadowing for the next part of the conversation.
Yeah.
Before we get into that, I want to go back to something you said earlier was, the last thing you gave up was the sales part, right? Because that's where you cut your teeth your entire career. So presumably a strength of yours, you're able to grow that way. One of the things that we've heard a lot of on this podcast and then also just in peer-to-peer type groups is the difficulty of letting go of something that people enjoy or they're good at, but they know the company is going to be better if I give that up. So what did that look like for you and how do you handle it to where you're bringing these people in and now you have to let them go do what you know you're good at?
Yep. Yeah, 100%. It's difficult in a couple areas. So one, having some systems and processes and accountability and KPIs, all that, and you can track it and you can help and teach and train and all that. Honestly, the hard part was, giving up what I felt was my standard as a founder owner is always going to be higher, right? It's always going to be to a higher level. And then trying to develop and be patient, but develop people to get there. And to be frank, there was a lot of mistakes that I look at in hindsight along the way. And so I think that's the biggest thing in letting it go is figuring out what the accurate true KPIs of, you know, hey, we're bringing on six sales reps or eight sales reps. What do good numbers look like? And what does a good compensation package look like for that? And trying to piece that together. And then knowing, you know, one of our biggest challenges is like, we're in flooring. You're not hiring people with years of flooring experience, you know, so there's a lot of training and product knowledge and et cetera. So, you know, you're lucky if after 90 days, you can get a good rhythm out of a sales rep, because of that. So, there's a lot of those things that we had to learn the hard way that I took for granted having been in the business for 20 years and, you know, that stuff came naturally to me at that time. So yes, that became a very difficult thing is to turn that over and watch, frankly, the numbers and the averages all drop. And then, you know, try to continue to teach and learn, you know, one to many at that point, but, you know, teach the team how to improve those KPIs.
Yeah. That I'm glad that you hit on that, Ben, because I was thinking the same thing is like when it's your strength and it's especially if it's something that you love doing, but you know, you have to scale and you have to be willing to tolerate, I guess, you know, to a certain degree, something that is below what your standard is, at least for the time being. You can always keep, hey, this is the standard, you got to clear it. But there's a learning curve in anything like that. So that's a big deal. That shows a lot of self-awareness too. And kind of driven a little bit more, but based on your goal. Before we move into like, it was good until it wasn't, I want to hear a little bit more about how you dealt with COVID, because we, you know, that's been a common theme with so many of our clients. I mean, clients, yes, at BGW CPA, but also guests on the podcast, because some it was a bonanza.
Yep.
Some it went from utter desperation to a bonanza, and others it just became we barely made it through. And some of them, you know, I'm thinking about Caritatio, where they had public venues that were shut down. And if it wasn't for all the government stimulus that came through, including the Restaurant Revitalization Act, they were lights out, you know? So I'm just curious, like, walk us through a little bit of what happened to you 4 years ago and subsequently, you know, during that COVID time.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I kind of had an earlier inclination to it than most. I happened to be in Vegas that January at the National Flooring Show. They call it Surfaces. And so it's the big convention, biggest one in the world for flooring every year in Vegas. And I went out there, and a whole wing of the convention center is from China. And this is when they had first started having lockdowns in December. And so, you know, the entire contingent from China is showing up with masks. And you're used to maybe seeing some foreign travelers with that, right? So masks are a little bit more common for some foreign travelers. But I mean, everybody had it, and it just became like, so I looked into it and kind of started kind of watching it as it progressed, right? As we got the first case, et cetera. And so when I got back and through February, we actually got our management team together. We were about, I think about 30 employees at the time, and got our management team together. And in our weekly leadership meetings, I literally said, hey, let's start making plans. If this happens, if we can't work, if, you know, X, Y, and Z happens, what are we going to do? And I'll never forget one of my managers came to me and goes, are you crazy? Like, you really think this is going to happen? I have no clue, but I said, it's happened elsewhere. I said, and I don't see an end to that. So I said, it's possible, you know? And so we started preparing for it. And obviously, you know, first week of March, I was actually in Raleigh. And I remember, as we all I'm sure do, those moments that just, you know, our lives changed. I remember sitting in the hotel room, and it was that I forget which game it was an NBA game that had canceled their game because COVID hit their locker room.
It was Oklahoma City Thunder, where we were filming it, and the game was supposed to start, and then everybody started leaving the stadium.
Exactly. I remember seeing that it starts spinning. That to me, that was a starting point of like when it hit mainstream, is because it had a mainstream effect. And then obviously, you know, college basketball, March Madness gets canceled. You know, I guess there was a conference tournament started getting canceled right after that. So I came back from Raleigh and same thing, kind of, you know, got everyone together and started kind of looking at those. And then I remember when the stay at home order hit, we were fortunate enough to be able to flip that switch. We had everything ready to go. Everyone was able to stay at home. You know, we kind of sent everyone home with what they needed to be functional and to do things. And I remember I had a company address and spoke to the team and said, hey, here's the way I'm looking at this. Number one, I'm going to pay everyone until we can't pay anymore. Like, this isn't, you know, we'll figure it out. Like, I don't know, but we'll figure it out. Number two, I said, look, but here's what we're going to do between here and when we know what the next step is. I forget the exact math, but I said, look, there's 40 hours in each of our weeks. We have 30 people. I said, if we take that math, so rough math in my head, the 40 times 30 is the same amount of hours that one person has in a work hours in a year. Right. And so 2000 or something like that came up. So I made some equivalency to that. And I said, if all of us spend the next 40 hours training, learning, find something relevant in your job that your manager can help you with it. And let's dive deeper into what we're doing. How much further ahead are we going to come out of this if we spent 3 straight weeks learning about how they make hardwood, or learning about how they install carpet, or learning about X, Y, and Z? I was like, let's just use this time to just get better. And goes back to a core principle. So you can see where my head is always at. But we looked at that and said, let's do what we can. So we're all home. We're all doing this. And so we really just teed up like that until as long as we could. We were fortunate in that the flooring industry was recognized as a construction industry. And so they were allowed to continue to work. And so ironically enough, about a month after shutdown, we saw a pretty good spike in our retail business because everyone was locked in their homes. So all of these flooring projects that they've been, you know, procrastinating on, they were calling saying, can you come to my home? So our retail business actually increased. Our multifamily commercial business went to zero. They were based on buying. They would buy properties off the MLS and then nothing was selling. No one was listing their house at the time. So they went to zero. Wow. But we were able to sustain the business through it on that. And so that's what we did to get through. PPP obviously came and helped. And then kind of on the backside of that, finally, I think it was more like Q4, our multifamily, this rental side of the business finally came back online. And we quickly kind of hit back to our normal run rates and then started exceeding them from there.
That is a very creative, that's the first time I've heard that response. Yep. You know, like, all right, guys, we're going to knuckle down versus like, oh, hope it's going to be okay. You know, whatever. Like, that's not leading. But there was a lot of that going on. But the fact that you were laser focused on, all right, learn. Let's apply and learn. What a great move, man. Good job.
Yeah. Well, and also, Chris, you talked about your core values continuing to come up, right? But this goes back to the very first question you answered, the intentionality. Mm-hmm. Purpose that you've had in everything you've described and then in that decision too, right? It wasn't a let's see what happens. It was a, all right, I'm going to be intentional. We're going to be purposeful and we're going to take advantage of whatever situation we're in.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's leadership 101, right? I mean, that's leadership. You have to be intentional. You have to be crystal clear.
Leadership 101. It happens far less often.
Yeah, 100%. But that's 100%. That's something that I think applies all over in life, right? Be very intentional and very specific about what that looks like, and that's as I always try to, lead someone in certain way. Like, here's what we're gonna do, or train them, or whatever. It's like you got to break this down into its simplest terms and be crystal clear about how you're measuring this and what it looks like, etc. So that's what we try to do because. To your point, we all know what happens if we say, let's just work at home and I'll call you tomorrow. And that's in my experience with things like that, I've experienced this in different jobs where we have off seasons and on seasons. When you have an off season with an employee and then you have an on season, it's amazing how they always say they're at 100% capacity. But I'm like, during the on season, you're doing 3X and you're at 100%. But then in the off season, you're like, hey, this is keeping me really busy. I'm at 100%. My point being is that you watch people as they expand and contract with what their expectations are on them for that period. And so that's kind of where it came from. Like, I got to be clear what they need to do or it's going to be nothing. Like, in that. And so yeah. it works out.
So Gary, you want to tee them up for the next part?
Yeah. So in hearing your story at this point is the big reason, like, oh, dude,
great story. Thanks for coming, folks.
Chris, yeah. You want to sign off now? We'll end it here.
You got to be on our podcast because it does. What's really cool is it dovetails into Jay Gault. And for anybody noticing, Jay Gault is for John Gault. If you've never read Atlas Shrugged, read it and it'll give some insight. But go ahead and take us into things are rocking and rolling. You make it through COVID, boom, boom, boom. You have an idea.
Yep. So ironically, at that same National Flooring Convention in Vegas, I had acquaintance, someone I knew in the industry, and had reconnected with him there at Vegas, and he was working for another company. So I've stayed in touch with him through the year, And as him and I were talking, I realized that there's some opportunity. So our at this point, two largest customers represent about 40% of our business. At this point, our run rate was about $1 million a month in revenue. So it's a roughly a $12 million run rate for the business. And so this contact I had said to him, I said, hey, he's an importer. He works for a factory that makes a flooring product overseas. And it's like, great. It's like, can you make this product here? I said, I'm using this product for my top two customers. I'm buying it through a distributor and they love it. So I don't necessarily want to change it, but can you make it? He's like, yeah, of course we can make that. I'm like, great. Give me a sample. Go through the couple months getting a sample. Long story short, eventually I go to these, my two large customers and say, hey, I got a proposal for you. I said, I've run the numbers. If I basically cut the distributor out and shorten the supply chain by direct, you're doing the volume for it where I can bring in containers. I'll set up the supply chain, manage the supply chain. I have a big enough warehouse at this point. I think we had close to 50,000 feet of warehouse space at this point between Raleigh and Charlotte. I said, we can manage it, no problem. I said, you know, if we do this in Charlotte alone, you'll save $1 million a year on your flooring. In Raleigh, you'll save $1 million a year. What I'd like is to grow with you into Atlanta and you'll save $2 million a year. So which one of you guys want to go to your boss and say, hey, I found a way to save us $4 million this year? I said, you know, I think it's a win-win. They said, we love it. Great. You guys do phenomenal work. This was just a win-win. I said, that's what I thought. Great. Went to the second customer, same thing. Great. Thought, great. This is awesome. We're going to expand. We're going to go from 12 million to 30 million, you know, next year. We could set it up, you know, the whole nine yards. And then in I don't know, end of January, let's say, of that year, our top two customers call us within 2 weeks of each other and say, hey, I got a call from corporate. We can't use you anymore. Okay. They say, why? No, I'm trying to figure it out. I'll let you know. Great. Let me know. Simultaneously, my distributor changes our terms from net 90 to net 30. And because obviously we're running a large account, say you need $100,000 that's due right now. So we pay the $100,000 and go to pick up another truckload of material. And they say, oh, you need to pay off the account or we're not releasing this material. We're not paying off the account. Like, what are you talking about? So it starts a cycle. And within 30 days after that, we were owed about $900,000 by these two large customers. Our distributor still wouldn't sell to us. As soon as we hit 30 days, they filed a lawsuit on the remaining balance on our account, because at that point it had gone 30, everything had gone overdue because they changed the terms to 30 days, and filed a lawsuit for the 100 grand that was still on the account. And it wasn't until about 2 months later that, or maybe 30 days after that point, but 2 months after it started, that I actually started putting the dots together. And I just never thought about my go. This distributor found out that they were about to lose some business, and it represented $200-300 million for them nationally with these two accounts. And so, so we went through that, and what that led to is it led to 6 months of, it was comical in hindsight, not at the time, of trying to figure out where you're going to stop the downfall. Right. So you go from $1 million to 600 grand a month. You're like, all right, let's redo all of our projections and budgets with 500,000 a month in revenue, you know, do a round of layoffs, stabilize there. Okay. We didn't stop the bleeding at 500. Now it's going down to 400. And all right, let's, you know, and you're trying to catch a falling knife, right? And there's just no good way to do it. And so it just kept spiraling. At this point, you know, we sued them for $10 million. In a countersuit because of, you know, the malicious, you know, practice, et cetera. And we just started going through the process. And in the middle of all this, at the time, at the beginning, I thought we had a decent, you know, retained earnings. But in reality, in hindsight, I had invested not only all my money personally into it to as seed money, but we had reinvested all of our profits for 3.5-4 years to the tune of close to $2 million at that point in our expanding. We had just opened up a new 30,000 foot warehouse in Charlotte. So we had a whole build out there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all of a sudden, I'm trying to stem these losses. We quickly go through all of our retained earnings because you have $900,000 that's owed to you for work done that you're not getting. It doesn't take long. Go to the bank to get a loan, and they come back and say, "We'll give you $100,000." I was like, "Wait, we were making $100,000 a month in profits." I was like, "Even if we're half the size, we're still going to be making $500,000-$600,000 a year." And couldn't get a loan, so passed on it. Then the lawyers come and say, "Okay, they're slowballing this. They're dragging it out. They're trying to bleed you dry. It's going to be about $200,000 to take this to trial, because it's in California. We have to hire California lawyers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera." And so after about 6 months of doing the balance sheet shuffle, as it became known, of selling assets and liquidating and all that fun stuff, trying to keep in front of things, we finally closed down, and probably one of the hardest days. Come home, tell my wife. So it's a hard when it becomes your baby for 4 years, it becomes a, we're going to fix this. We're going to take care of it. You're so optimistic to finally make that decision. It's hard.
Yeah. That's the side of entrepreneurism that those who aren't in it rarely see.
It's one thing to get your spouse's blessing to invest $250,000 into a business and then not take, literally never take a distribution for 4 years, even though you have a successful business. And tell her for 4 years, "We're just investing in our future. We're just investing in our future." It's another thing to come home and say it's gone. We're not getting it back. Yeah. And then it's another thing when she gets named in a lawsuit from the distributor, and saying now they're going to, private investigators, they're hiring private investigators for the lawsuit to do. I mean, it just gets to the side of things that you don't think about, right? Yeah. You don't think about those things, and you don't think, frankly, you're naive. I'm naive to think that that's not out there. That this starts with, I'm trying to serve my customer and I'm trying to save them money. I'm trying to, create value in the marketplace. You don't think about that other side. And that's a hard lesson to learn, but it's a very, very important lesson. I get often asked, what do you learn from that? And number one is as an entrepreneur, you constantly have to adjust your risk tolerance. And I went all in over and over and over again. And at some point, you need to put people around you that can help you properly analyze risk and say, let's analyze this from that side or from this side, et cetera, so that you can know, hey, you got all this at stake here. Let's not play this card yet. Right. Let's prepare for it longer before we play that. It's a great idea, but this isn't the time. And that's the difference between a salesman mentality versus a CFO mentality. Right. And those are important lessons to learn to about risk tolerance in your business.
It's a weird part of a conversation that happens a lot with business owners in the wealth management space of, because you're in the business all the time, you don't view the risk. But if you were to look at somebody's portfolio and 95% of their net worth was in one company, let alone a very small company, right? Every single person in the country would talk about how crazy and absurd that is.
Yep, 100%.
Yeah, but it's easy to do because you know that way better than anything else that you could be, where you could be putting your money.
Yep. And look, there's a good ROI on that, but the risk when you're young, don't have a family, and you don't have millions of dollars in wealth behind you, you can take those risks. But adjust that to when you have a family, have a multi-million-dollar business, you have a lot larger equity piece in there and cash in there, you have to adjust that risk. And that's the transition that I certainly didn't make and missed, but that, to your point, often doesn't get made in other aspects, maybe not as drastically as I did, but certainly diversification does not happen very often.
Yeah. So
Yeah.
I appreciate you sharing what you learned there. Can you talk about where do you go next? Because I want us to get to Jay Galt before we wrap up today, because I think there's a lot of things there, especially with that story. But yeah, let's move to, okay, what do you do after you go home and have that conversation with your wife?
Yeah, well, you first of all, you learn and you grieve, and all of those natural emotions that you go through, and that's challenging for a multitude of reasons. One of the things that I learned that I've had to learn since then, and first advice any entrepreneur ever comes to me, first advice I get to them, invest in relationships first, and that's something I didn't do. For years, I invested in the business, and I frankly went all in, and my relationship suffered. My relationship with my wife suffered, relationship with family, friends, because guess where I spent 12 hours a day, and I thought that was the right thing to do. So it wasn't it wasn't to be malicious. So where do you go next? First of all, you learn, right? You sit back and say, okay, here's where I am. Here's what happened. Here's what it looks like. Let's start building it back. And you start with those relationships that are important, and you work out from there and build it back. Second thing from a professional standpoint is all right, now where do I put my energy into now? Building a flooring business wasn't the next up on my list, and so but it's where do you put your heart? Right. And seeing that, look, there's when you have your heart into something, there's an order of magnitude there that is important. So, to use Simon Sinek's classic, start with why is like figuring out what your why is, where you're going to be, your mission-based business, what you're going to be attached to, that you really can. So I spent a year kind of dabbling around, helping some other businesses, grow, running different, I mean, just different little things, but it was really, I just kept searching for that next thing. And I really honestly had no idea what it was. I had ideas of what I might want to do, but opportunities never presented themselves, et cetera. So really it came into learning. And one of the things that any entrepreneur learns in business, whether they want to or not, is that they're their own lid on the business. And so they're their own reason that they have challenges or that they can't grow, and so they have to keep pushing themselves. And so I realized that, if I want to take success to the next step, whatever that success might look like, I need to invest into relationships. I need to invest into me. I need to be the healthiest, best version of me so that I can create and be part of a healthy company and provide and be the best leader I can. And so honestly, there's a lot of self-work that gets done after circumstances like that.
Yeah, powerful. Well, you said you at the beginning of this thing, you're a lifetime learner, or you're big about learning. And what we didn't say was learning can sometimes cost us a ton and be extremely painful. Some of the biggest lessons actually do. But that actually leads us into Jay Galt, and I. It's funny because I never really thought, oh, it's John Galt out of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. Again, anybody who hasn't read that book, it's worth reading. But a friend said, out of our greatest pain often becomes our greatest blessing to somebody else. And I see you doing that with what you're doing with Jay Galt. So walk us through what it is, what the service is, and why what you learned there has applied so well here.
Yeah, absolutely. So this opportunity came across, and I started digging into it, and I'd never heard of Jay Galt, the company, and so I kind of dug into it. And what the company does is it helps small business owners build business credit, their business credit score specifically, so that the business can have a firm financial foundation to support itself, without the need of the owner to essentially co-sign, personally guarantee, use its assets as collateral, et cetera, and support the business. And so kind of read through what they did and had that like classic jaw on the floor. Like, why didn't I know about this 5 years ago? Like, this would have saved me some grief when I went through some hard times. Like, and what's funny is I get that response probably 50% of the time when I'm sitting down with small business owners. Like, Chris, this is awesome. 100% we need this. But I'm almost mad at you, Chris, that you didn't come to me 2, 3, 4 years ago about this. You know how much money I've spent on crap? I'm like, I have some stories I can tell you too. I know. and so it really, to your point, the pain and suffering and hard lessons that I learned finally came to a place where it were a couple of things. Number one, it was almost therapeutic. I remember sitting with the owner of Jay Galt and a couple of the executives and telling my story. And I was like, this might be the first time I've ever talked about this in 2 years. I'm like, this might be the first time I've actually like walked through this with somebody on the outside. And what I've learned is exactly that, is that, you know, my pain can be a blessing and be used for a lot of good. And not to say that every business was going to go through something I did or that I went through, but if I can save some business owners some money and protection, and you know, help them, to Ben's point, keep their cash in their pocket at home, divested, invested in other things, rather than constantly loaning cash back into their business, those are all great things that we can get to. So that's literally what Jay Galt does. We help companies build their business credit score so that, and more than that, we then connect them and help them get to what we call corporate lending, true commercial lending attached to the EIN, no attachment to the owners or their social security number, et cetera. And then we help set them up for success. Our mission statement is to protect the small business owner and help them prosper. And so we walk alongside of them and help them get to that point where, you know, as many people have said to me, and this is that, Chris, I can sleep at night now knowing that my house is not at risk because of whatever can happen over there in the business. And that's our ultimate goal.
Yeah. I think that's, something like anybody that's an entrepreneur out there running a business, even if you're running a larger business, this is one of those things that is often overlooked. And it's not that expensive to have somebody like Jay Galt actually walk you through it. It's not like they're going to send you just the manuals. You just go do it, go to a seminar. No, they're actually walking you through it in a very affordable rate. And this isn't a sales pitch. Like, there's nothing in it for me, but like, if we just knew what we know now, back when we were much younger running companies, we would have saved a lot of time and money and shortened the curve, you know? So I just think that's a really cool thing. So, you know, I'm really glad to see you use your pain and suffering and lessons learned and not let it remove the fire from you, because clearly you got fire, you know, but it can like take the wind out of your sails at some point and you just can't give up. So, you know, thank you, because it's very, you know, your story is very inspiring to me.
I appreciate that. Is a, like I said, fear of failure is a curse. And in order to live that, you take the failure and you got to keep on moving. And I firmly believe that we were put on this earth to make a difference, and the end is not written yet. So we keep on marching towards it.
So Chris, where, first off, before I even do that, the outro of sending people places, I just want to stop for a second and thank you for the vulnerability of the story that you shared. It means a lot. And I know that other people are going to be able to resonate. People are going to learn, and hopefully other people are going to be able to adjust their course to make sure that they're taking some lessons away from today. So I wanted to thank you for that first.
I appreciate that. I appreciate it a lot.
Where can people go to connect with you and also to check out Jay Galt?
Yeah. So our website is jgalt.io and then /clucy, C-L-O-U-C-Y. So jgalt.io/clucy, C-L-O-U-C-Y. On there's all my contact information, and they can simply click to schedule an appointment or reach out to me via email or phone or whatever from there.
Perfect. Gary, anything else from you?
Nope. You've been really great. I feel like I've known you forever. But that's what vulnerability will do. It just shortens the cycle time, man. I mean, you can spend decades with somebody and really not know them. But when you are willing to vulnerably share your journey, it just shortens the cycle time and it just connects much faster. So again, I just want to say thank you, Chris. Wonderful episode. I also think it's funny because we've recorded two episodes today and both of you guys mentioned E-Myth. I just think it's funny.
I'm pretty sure it's been the book that's been the most referenced on this podcast. A lot of people refer to it.
Yeah. So that's a good one. It's up in my bookshelf behind me there too.
Same with me. Yep. Well, Chris, thanks again. I can't wait to get this out so people can hear this. I appreciate it.
Awesome. I appreciate you guys a lot.